Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
There's no business as usual at U.S. embassies around the world. What happens when our representatives overseas shut their doors? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast. It's Monday, the 5th of August. Good to have you with us. If you called up a bunch of American embassies right now, you'd probably hear something like this.
You have reached the Embassy of the United States of America in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. We are currently closed.
More than a dozen U.S. embassies and consulates in the Middle East and Africa are closed through Saturday. The U.S. government is warning of possible terror attacks. This impacts security, politics, and travel, of course, but it also affects one of the biggest areas of an embassy's business, which is business. Marketplace's Mark Garrison has the story.
Say embassy, and you might think first of where to go if you ever screw up and lose your passport overseas. Embassies will take care of that for you, but they spend a lot more time promoting American companies.
Increasingly in a globalized economy, U.S. embassies are really the front lines for American business.
Stuart Eisenstadt is a former deputy treasury secretary. He estimates that in some embassies, around half the work done relates to trade, and the region under lockdown is a crucial market. Wendy Chamberlain, former U.S. ambassador to Pakistan, is now president of the Middle East Institute.
We sell billions of dollars worth of defense and communications and security equipment to the Gulf. It creates an enormous amount of jobs back in the United States.
And it's not just defense and oil. Farmers and businesses of all kinds and all sizes rely on embassies to open doors to new customers and partnerships. Now, former U.S. Trade Representative Susan Schwab is worried about current efforts to help American companies grow globally.
Obviously, that comes to a screeching halt if the U.S. government is not open for business itself.
There's a tangible value to having offices abroad pushing American business. Business professor Andy Rose at UC Berkeley studied the impact.
When a country builds an extra consulate abroad, their exports rise by around 6%.
President Obama has pledged to double American exports by 2015. That's a lot tougher when the Americans charged with selling America can't get to work. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Fights between two big corporations don't usually affect our day-to-day lives. Until our TVs go dark, that is. Yes, CBS and Time Warner Cable are still fighting over money, which means no CBS or Showtime again tonight for Time Warner customers in L.A., New York, and Dallas. CBS is even blocking access to its web episodes if you have Time Warner Internet. Look, if all you want to do is watch Under the Dome tonight, Sally Herships may be able to help.
Time Warner and CBS may have betrayed you, but your TV signal is still there waiting for you, traveling magically through the air.
As it always has.
Bill Hayes is director of engineering at Iowa Public Television. He says TV works pretty much the same as it did in the 50s, with radio waves.
An RF signal traveling through free space to an antenna, and then the antenna receiving it and transferring it to the receiver.
Right. You'll need an antenna. But you'll get the broadcast networks like CBS and NBC for free.
The most popular, the most viewed programming on TV is available free.
Denny Duplessis owns Denny's TV Antenna Service.com. He's used to the network cable fistfights. About 5% of his business comes from consumers trapped in the middle. Antennas can run anywhere from $20 to hundreds of dollars, depending on how hard it is for the signal to reach you.
Well, to be honest, there aren't a lot of alternatives.
Mark Robichaud is the editor of Multichannel News. He says you can watch new episodes on Amazon a week later or switch to a cable alternative like satellite TV or Fios. And there's Aereo, which uses a special signal to bring broadcast to the web.
But it costs $8 a month. So if you're a cable subscriber, you're not going to want to solve this problem by spending more money on it.
Robichaud says this game of chicken is costing both Time Warner and CBS. But at least there's some drama to follow while your set is blank. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
In other media news, in the last few minutes, we've learned that Amazon.com founder Jeff Bezos is buying The Washington Post. Bezos will pay $250 million for the paper. You can read more about this deal, including letters from Post officials and Bezos himself, at marketplace.org. President Obama will be in Phoenix tomorrow for yet another speech aimed at the middle class. This one will focus on owning a home, something this president and his predecessors have aggressively promoted. But middle-class families saw their home values take a huge hit in the past few years, so maybe it's not such a great investment. Marketplace's Noel King reports.
To American presidents, owning a home has always been the American dream.
Few things define what it is to be middle class in America more than owning your own cornerstone of the American dream, a home.
Hope is reborn for couples dreaming of owning homes
and made home ownership possible for more Americans.
We should also give poor families more help to move into homes of their own.
Right here in America, if you own your own home, you're realizing the American dream.
But to economists, it's a gamble.
On your particular neighborhood and your particular building, which may or may not work out for you, either because a tree falls down on your house or because the local plant closes.
Adam Posen is president of the Peterson Institute for International Economics. And while it has always been a bet, the recession changed the odds of home ownership paying off as a winning bet. Ray Bashara of the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis has been studying post-recession recovery. He says the average household has recovered about 63% of the wealth it lost, but households that had money invested in the stock market, mostly wealthy households, recovered more. People who have most of their money tied up in their homes?
Well, they haven't done so well. You know, house prices are still 30% below where they were in the 2006 peak. About 70% of the debt on household balance sheets is mortgage debt.
So I asked Bashara, if you want to get into the middle class or stay there, is the stock market a safer bet than buying a house?
Historically, you know, the stock market has outperformed the housing market, which is a way of saying if your primary purpose as a young person is to make good investments and generate a high return, it's not clear that home ownership is the best route to that.
Bashara says diversifying assets is key because achieving the American dream isn't so simple anymore. I'm Noel King for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, it was two indices down, one up. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. If you're drinking a bottle of water or a can of Coke listening to this show, there's about a 1 in 3 chance you're going to recycle it. Cities have been trying to up those odds, but it's tough and expensive. Sarah McKemmon has the story of one bottle.
You finish a jug of milk, you toss it in recycling. That's it for you. But in another sense, it's just the beginning.
This is the first sorting station. This is where we pull out the trash or anything that's not supposed to be in there.
At a recycling plant in Des Moines, manager Kelly McReynolds stands in a maze of conveyor belts and big metal chutes. Sun beats down through a steel roof as workers separate piles of trash into groups: paper, plastic, aluminum.
Some material goes to China, some to Mexico City, some stays as close as Cedar Rapids, Iowa, and some just right down the road, less than 6 blocks away.
The plant makes money off selling those materials and shares the profit with the city. In Des Moines, that revenue covers less than half of the cost of the recycling program. But that requires an upfront investment in collection, transportation, and sorting. Part of the problem is people drop all kinds of things in those recycling bins.
Plastic bags, shopping bags, dog chain, garden hoses.
Which can gum up the machine. It's these types of problems that frustrate Mark Lichtenstein.
Well, I'm president of a national recycling coalition, but I'm not here to tell you that recycling is the panacea or silver bullet. Recycling has inherent problems if it's not done correctly.
Another problem, too many things that could be recycled are still going in the trash. To change that, experts say you have to make it more convenient. The city of Houston is exploring an approach called One Bin for All. Gary Redor is with Houston's Solid Waste Management Department.
And the concept there is that just put everything in one bin, not just recyclables, but even trash, you know, your household garbage.
The catch, and the reason everyone isn't doing this already, is that sorting is expensive. And when you throw your baby's diapers in with your junk mail, usable stuff can get contaminated.
I think the verdict is still out whether you'll be able to do that at a cost which is, you know, feasible.
Another way to get people to recycle, make them pay more for trash. In Middletown, Rhode Island, coordinator Will Cronin says recycling is free, but trash bags cost $2 apiece.
Anytime you have a pay-as-you-throw program, you have the financial incentive to recycle more. In other words, you'll be pulling out your newspapers and milk jugs in order to make more room for your non-recyclable waste.
And keeping more trash out of the landfill. Mick Berry, a recycling consultant based in Iowa, says that saves cities money in the long run.
Not driving the extra 20 or 30 miles from point A to the landfill versus going to the recycling center, all those costs never show up as a check back to the city or the municipality. However, that is money that they have avoided spending.
But whatever system a city chooses, Berry says it's going to cost something.
Recycling is never free. It may look free, but somewhere along the line, somebody's paying for that truck to come by.
Even if that recycling truck still only picks up about a third of what America throws away. In Des Moines, Iowa, I'm Sarah McCammon for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Everywhere I went in China, the best sellers in every single bookshop were self-help books.
How China's changing relationship to money is changing the way people think. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average started the week by taking a step back, sliding 46 points, 0.3%, to close at 15,612. The NASDAQ added 3 points, 0.1%, to finish at 3692. The S&P was off 2 points, 0.1%, ending at 1707. Apple helped steady the tech-heavy NASDAQ, gaining 1.5%. Apple celebrated a win in its patent war with Samsung when a trade ruling against older iPhones and iPads was thrown out. In other tech stocks, Cisco added 0.4%. Hewlett-Packard was off 0.1%. Qualcomm fell 0.7% after an analyst downgraded its shares. Bank stocks eased. JPMorgan Chase was off 0.7%. Citigroup and Bank of America slipped 0.25%. Wells Fargo shaved 0.3%. European markets were mixed. France's CAC 40 gained 0.1%. Germany's DAX lost 0.1%. Britain's FTSE lost 0.4%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.64%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. The Commerce Department lets us know what the trade deficit was in June. President Obama makes a stop in Burbank. You can see him on The Tonight Show with Jay Leno. And during his lifetime, he immortalized the Campbell's soup can and gave us all permission to seek our 15 minutes of fame. Andy Warhol was born on August 6, 1928. He'd be 85. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Lizzie O'Leary in for Kai Rizdahl. When is a sports story not a sports story? When it's about money. A lot of money. Major League Baseball suspended a dozen players today for 50 games for using performance-enhancing drugs, and one very special player for 211 games. That's Alex Rodriguez, A-Rod, the highest-paid player in sports. The monies the Yankees could save on his salary means they can spend it on lots of other things and people. Stan Alcorn has the story.
Major League Baseball Commissioner Bud Selig says A-Rod is facing unprecedented punishment because he tried to cover up his drug violations. At age 38, that two-year suspension could be career-ending. But for the Yankees?
The Yankees stand to save anywhere between $60 and $100 million, which is a fair amount of change even for the New York Yankees.
Alan Milstein is a lawyer who represents professional athletes. That $100 million figure is what's still owed under a 10-year contract signed back in 2007. Michael McCann, director of the Sports and Entertainment Law Institute, says the Yankees are paying up now for the younger A-Rod.
The Yankees made a gamble. They decided in the short term that this deal makes a lot of sense for us, but now they're probably hoping that they don't have to pay him.
With the extra money from Rodriguez's salary, the Yankees could hire more pitchers or go after Baltimore Orioles catcher Matt Wieters.
The Red Sox, Orioles, and Rays and Blue Jays are not going to be happy to see Alex Rodriguez suspended because now their rival can go spend money on other needs.
But the Yankees can't break out the checkbook just yet. A-Rod says he intends to appeal the suspension, and he's allowed to keep playing as long as his appeal is alive.
They'll still have to pay him as long as he's in the lineup, as long as he's on the roster.
Patrick Risch, director of Sports Impact, thinks that appeal process should be over before next year's season. In New York, I'm Stan Alcorn for Marketplace.
The social safety net is the subject of a lot of debate right now. Some say we're spending too much on it, others too little, and those debates can quickly devolve into shouting matches. To spark more thoughtful conversations, we've been asking you, our listeners, to share your safety net tales. It's a series we call Show Me Your Safety Net. And today, Marketplace's wealth and poverty reporter Chrissy Clark brings us one story from a listener in Grosse Pointe Park, Michigan.
To understand Paul Daniels' feelings about safety nets, especially ones funded by the government, you need to know a few things about him. Daniels is a 55-year-old building engineer. That's the fancy name for a guy who takes care of an office building's heating and air conditioning and plumbing systems. But here's the important part. Being a building engineer is not what Paul Daniels wanted to be when he grew up. He keeps a little homage to his true ambition in a room in his house.
This is my dream of being a journalist right here, you know, with my typewriter and my bottle of Crown Royal. Actually doesn't work.
Part of why Daniels did not become a writer has to do with a piece of advice his mother gave him when he was a kid, growing up without a lot of money in a suburb of Detroit.
I always used to say to him, be a something.
That's Lucille Daniels, 87 years old. She lives with her son now that she's too frail to live alone.
Take up a trade, carpenter, electrician, or whatever. You know what I'm saying? Would have been nice if he'd been a lawyer or a doctor or something, but how many people do that?
I say that I was a depression child by proxy.
That's Paul Daniels again.
My parents, especially my mother, were absolutely destitute during the Depression. Her father lost his job. They had a child die. They lost their home. My mother drummed into our heads that you had better work hard and be ready for tougher times.
For a while, that message competed with other messages he was hearing, messages from people at school.
I couldn't spell to save my life. And yet when I would write something, the teachers always just raved about it.
Messages from newspaper editors who published a handful of articles he wrote.
The Troy Somerset Gazette, those are the first people that encouraged me to pursue my writing.
Messages from motivational speakers.
When I hear people say at every commencement that I've ever been to, follow your dreams.
But in the end?
I think, well, fine, follow your dreams, but if they don't work out, don't blame anybody else for them, because that was a choice you made.
The choice Daniels made was to walk away from his original dream. It was a painful calculation.
I might have become a well-known writer, but to take that risk, I just didn't want to end up being broke in my old age. So I worked some jobs for some companies that I hated to support myself, and so someday I will be able to retire.
The trade-off still haunts him. But it's a trade-off he thinks not enough people make.
I've been killing myself my entire life to take care of myself, and I see other people collecting. I'm paying, and they're collecting.
Which brings us back to the safety net. The collecting Daniels is talking about is collecting money from government assistance programs, like unemployment benefits.
I'm not saying that, for instance, I've never received unemployment in my life. But I know a lot of people that collect unemployment, and it's not really that they need to. It's more like a lifestyle.
And this is where things get tricky. Even though Daniels admits he's used a few safety net programs himself, a couple months on unemployment insurance years ago, a federal student loan in college, he feels like mostly he's made his safety net himself through sacrifice, and he doesn't have much sympathy for those who, as he sees it, have not. Of course, the thing about safety nets is that their usefulness can be in the eye of the beholder. You know why you need them when you need them. When you see someone else need one, it's a judgment call. Oh, and there is a postscript to this story.
As a young boy growing up in Detroit, I dreamed of adventures in strange, exotic, and faraway places.
That's the trailer for a documentary Daniels made a few years ago about his time in Antarctica doing building maintenance for the U.S. research station.
We're down here at the bottom of the tunnel. The area we're in right now is 55 below zero year-round.
He paid for the movie himself, did all the camera work, and hired someone to edit it. It made it into a handful of film festivals, and it made his mother proud.
Whatever he wants to do, he accomplishes. It's just hard work and his strong
will.
Strong will, hard work, and saying no to dreams you can't afford. That's how Daniels defines his safety net. Still, he says he wishes he could have been a full-time writer. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace. A lot on this program about China and its incredible economic growth. Today, we're bringing you the stories of five people trying to make it in Shanghai. A factory girl, a property developer, a manipulative tycoon. They're all characters in Ta Shao's new book, Five Star Billionaire. The book is fiction, but it feels like a very real glimpse into modern China. Ta Shao joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So let's talk about this novel. It follows five characters in Shanghai, and to someone who has never been there, seems to paint an economic picture of the new China. What were you trying to show in this book?
Well, I was trying to show how really China is shaping the lives of tens of millions, hundreds of millions of people. Countries like Malaysia, China, Indonesia, Thailand, all these people are reacting to the rise of China. And what I hoped to do was for the readers to be able to see China through their eyes and see that the rise of new China is something incredibly complex.
Is this a story about money?
Absolutely, it is. It's also a story about how money shapes people's way of thinking and how I think, you know, Asia has come to define itself in relation to money. And I think that's what's really at the heart of this novel, the way modern Asian people have really quite fundamentally changed the way they think.
I want to talk a little bit about the characters in your book because this is fiction, but you have painted the picture of five archetypes, really, of modern China. Tell me about them and why you chose these characters, why you created these people.
Well, I created these five characters because I wanted to show how Asia is not just about it's really about many different stories. So they all come from very different social backgrounds. And they react to China, therefore, in a very different way. So, for example, Justin is a very successful property developer. He comes from a long-established Chinese family. And so he sees China's rise in a very different way from, say, Phoebe, who's a factory girl struggling to make her mark in this new city.
Your chapter headings, I want to read a few of them. Move to where the money is. Embrace your bright future. Know when to cut your losses. Explain those a little bit.
Well, they were really inspired by the fact that everywhere I went in China, the best sellers in every single bookshop were self-help books. And they were largely self-help books that dealt with how to get rich. And so I wanted to write a pastiche of those self-help books. I also wanted to make a small commentary on the way China has seized on this very American idea of self-help, that the idea that you can improve every aspect of your life by reading a book. When you look at the way life in China is now, there's obviously a lot of money, which has transformed people's lives, but there's also a lot of unhappiness.
Who is your audience for this novel, and what do you want people who know nothing about China to take away from it?
I think my audience is a global audience. I don't write for a global audience, but I think I'm lucky in that all the things I'm interested in as a writer are the things that I think everyone else is interested in. I think we're all interested in how the world is changing. We're all interested in shifting boundaries. The way I see it is that coming from small-town Malaysia and going to Shanghai isn't necessarily very different from coming from small-town Iowa and going to New York to reinvent yourself, to seek a new life. And so I guess as a writer, I'm really interested in how people are similar in their differences. And if I think about my reader, I'd really like them to take that away, the fact that everything is ultimately very universal, in spite of the fact that the setting might be different.
Tashao is the author of the novel Five Star Billionaire. Tash, thank you so much.
Thanks, Lizzie.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, a growing number of Americans rent their homes. What if President Obama was one of them? Zillow.com, which chatted with the president today, did the math on the White House, valuing it at $319 million. That means it would rent for $1.8 million a month. TheAtlantic.com says that since Obama's worth about $7 million, he could pay that rent for about 4 months. If Mitt Romney had won the election, he'd be able to stick around a lot longer. He'd be able to rent the White House until August of 2024. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow lost 46 points, 0.3%. The Nasdaq gained 3 points, 0.1%. And the S&P 500 slipped 2 points, 0.1%. Our producers include Bridget Bodner, Mary Dew, Nancy Fargalli, Millie Jefferson, John Ketchum, Jolie Myers, and Chow Tu. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and we'll see you back here tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.